Okay, let's unpack this. We have a question today that it looks deceptively simple on the surface.
It really does.
But it's one of those perfect cases where, personal identity crashes right into 2,000 years of legal and scriptural interpretation.
It's a classic deep dive dilemma.
Yeah.
The question for our listener is, on which arm do I bind the arm phylactery during morning prayer?
And if you're right-handed, you put it on the left arm. If you're left-handed, on the right. Simple, right?
Well, not so fast.
Except our listener's definition of handedness is anything but simple.
This specific learner presents a textbook case of dual dominance. They were born left-handed, but then society, school, training, it all intervened.
Right.
So they now write, cut, use a screwdriver, and, handle their phone exclusively with their right hand. That's the hand of fine motor skill, the learned habit.
But then this is the key. Their natural inherent power remains on the left side. They train in mixed martial arts, and they're defined as a left side striker. Their strength, the ability to generate force, what the ancient texts call laka or work capacity, is still fundamentally left dominant.
So we have a profound conflict for this deep dive. When the law asks, which is your dominant hand? Are we talking about learned skill and fine motor control,
More?
or are we prioritizing raw inherent strength and work performance? That's the mission, tracing the legal argument from the foundational verse to the final decision.
And it all starts with finding the weaker hand. So let's go back to the beginning, because that's where this whole idea of weak even comes from.
The source of the law is in the book of Exodus, chapter 13. The commandment tells us to place the tefillin as a sign upon yadecha, just your hand.
Okay, your hand. But there's a key linguistic detail here, isn't there? The word yadecha is actually written in the original Hebrew text with an extra letter, a letter hey.
Exactly. It's spelled Yad Kiha.
And that single, seemingly unnecessary letter is, well, it's everything.
It is. It's the moment where the textual scholars found a deliberate clue. In the Talmud, Rav Ashi interprets Yad Keha not just as your hand, but as Yad Keha,
Which means,
the duller, or more accurately, the weak hand.
wait, so the law isn't about binding a sign to your most active, powerful arm. It's explicitly commanded to be placed on the weaker arm.
Yes, that fundamentally changes the ritual's intent.
It really
It
does.
shifts the focus away from just marking the strong arm and toward binding and, you could say, elevating the less dominant side of yourself.
Rabbeinu Yonatan of Lunel ran with this.
He did. He affirmed this by stating Yad Keha is the left hand because it lacks strength to perform work for most people.
Okay, so for the majority of people right-handers,
Yeah.
the left arm is the default weaker hand, and that's where the tefillin goes.
Exactly. And this framework then gives us the precise definition of an eider, a left-handed person.
An eider isn't just someone who writes with their left hand.
No, not at all. They are defined as someone whose right hand is kihadol, defective, or weak in its ability to perform primary work.
Which means an eider places the tefillin on their right arm, because for them, the right is the weaker one. The law stays perfectly consistent. You always target the weaker hand.
Yes, but this is the crucial pivot. How did the sages justify calling the left hand universally weaker in the first place when the text just says hand?
That's what I was wondering.
That's where it gets really interesting. They needed scriptural proof that when the Bible uses the generic term yad for hand, it's actually referring to the left hand.
And that the right hand, yemin, is reserved for something else.
For specialized positive action.
This whole section is just a master class in reading context. They had to prove a symbolic difference between just the hand and the right hand. So let's look at their evidence.
Okay, the first proof uses cosmology, creation. It's from Isaiah 48, where God says, "My yad founded the earth, and my yemina, my right hand, spread out the heavens."
At first glance, that just sounds like, poetic parallelism, but what's the interpretation there?
The sources immediately tie it back to Genesis. The heavens, God's domain, are perfect. They remain blessed. So they are linked to the strong, positive side, yemina, the right hand.
And the earth.
Well, the earth was cursed after the sin of Adam and Eve. It represents struggle, the difficult, the flawed. It's passive compared to the heavens' activity. Therefore, the general, less positive term, yada, gets symbolically linked to the earth and by extension to the left hand.
So it's a theological way of defining left as passive or weaker. That sets the whole metaphorical stage.
Yeah.
Left is passive or cursed, Right is active and blessed.
And they solidify this with narrative examples, yeah, like the story of Jael and Sisera.
Right. Jael delivered the fatal blow with a tent peg and a hammer.
And the verse describes her action very specifically. She put her yad to the tent peg and her yemina, right hand, to the workman's hammer.
So she's holding the passive object, the peg, with her generic yad.
Her left hand.
And delivering the active, decisive, striking blow with her yemina, her right hand.
Precisely. The act of holding, of stabilizing, the passive role is assigned to the left hand, the yad. The act of definitive active work, the hammering, is for the right hand, the yemina.
The symbolism is just so consistent.
Yeah.
It bridges the cosmological and the human.
And they even bring in King David. He's asking God for vengeance in the Psalms.
Why do you return your yad and your yemineka from within your bosom, consume it?
Right. The context here is delay versus action. David is frustrated. The sources interpret the withdrawn or delayed action, the holding back, as being symbolized by the passive yad, the left hand.
And when he wants God to act?
When God is urged to take decisive, positive action, he is urged to extend his yemineka, his right hand.
It's incredible. They use these three distinct biblical contexts, cosmology, narrative, and an emotional plea to definitively establish a legal foundation.
A foundation that says when the law simply states hand, it means the left hand.
Because scripturally, the left hand is understood as the weaker, more passive counterpoint to the powerful, active right hand.
And this metaphorical framework is critical because it explains why the goal is the weaker hand. The ritual is engaging the side of ourselves associated with passivity and delay.
Okay, that brings us right to the core dilemma for our listener. The mandate is clear. Find the weak hand.
Hmm.
But how do you measure weakness today, especially for someone who was forced to switch?
Is it the inherited power, the MMA strength, or is it the learned skill, the writing, and the tools?
This is where the legal authorities wrestled with the exact same ambiguity. We can start with Rabbi Natan, who offered a very intuitive, habit-based solution.
He looked at the commandments layout, ukashartam viktafatam.
You shall bind and you shall write. Mm-hmm. Bind and write. They're right next to each other in the verse.
Yes. Rabbi Natan argued that this proximity links the act of binding to the hand that does the writing.
So if you write with your right hand, that defines your dominance, and therefore you bind the tefillin on your left arm. It's a skill-based, learned habit rule.
It seems like a very pragmatic, almost modern way to look at it. If you write and do fine motor tasks with your right hand, that's your dominant hand. End of story.
It does seem logical, but this is where the legal giants of the next generation disagreed. It led to a major intellectual schism.
It did. When Rabbi Isaac Alfasi, the Rif, compiled his massive legal code, he completely omitted Rabbi Natan's writing argument.
He's just ignored the proximity rule. That seems like a huge break from tradition. Why would the Rif dismiss such a simple functional definition?
Because the Rif and those who followed him, they prioritized Rav Ashi's original scriptural interpretation, Yad Kiha, the duller hand.
So they thought the measure of dominance must be something else.
It had to be inherent strength and control over work, ko'ash or malaka, not just the learned habit of holding a quill.
So the Rif is suggesting that if you have raw inherent power in your left hand, but you learn to write with your right,
mm-hmm,
your dominance might still be defined by that inherent power.
Precisely. They were concerned that writing is often just a taught skill, a learned overlay, while the core ability to perform serious crafts or physical work is the truer measure of a hand's control.
And this emphasis on true control brings us to Maimonides, the Rambam, who really formalized this whole work capacity test.
Yes. Rambam defined the iter, the lefty, not based on their writing hand, but as someone who is shalate with that hand.
Sholate. What does that mean exactly?
It means dominant, controlling, or mastering. The crucial measure is the quality and control over serious work and crafts.
So the question becomes, which hand is the master of work?
Exactly. And Rambam then gives a specific test case that is almost tailor-made for our listener scenario.
What does he say?
He says, if a person writes perfectly well with their right hand, but when they try to perform any serious craft, any malaka, with that hand, if their work is defective or ruined, then that right hand is actually considered their weak hand.
Wow. So the quality of the output defines the dominance. It doesn't matter if you can write your name beautifully.
No. If you can't build or fix anything properly with that hand, it's defined as weak.
That's the heart of it. The skill must be robust enough to qualify as effective malaka. If the right hand is skilled enough for all the necessary functions of craft and control, then it is the dominant hand.
Regardless of the raw strength in the other arm.
So let's apply this powerful legal framework directly to our learner. We are aiming for the weak hand, and our criteria is control over work, shalate, not just MMA power.
We revisit the profile. Right hand for writing, tools, screwdrivers, cutting, using the phone. Left hand for MMA striking, soccer power.
Okay. Since the right hand is used for tools and writing while performing all those complex, fine motor tasks required for everyday life, it seems to satisfy the standard of shalate. It controls the work.
It is not defective.
And that is the deciding factor according to the majority ruling of the Riff and Rambam. The controlled ability to handle tools and execute daily crafts defines the dominant hand.
So since the right hand is dominant, the tefillin must be placed on the left arm, like the majority of the population.
But what about the fact that the learner is clearly generating maximum force with their left side? Doesn't that immense power swing the definition back?
It complicates it for sure, but it doesn't flip the requirement. The sources classify the situation differently.
How so?
A person who demonstrates exceptional skill, control, and power in both hands, someone who controls both hands equally, is called shole bishtai yadayim.
Ambidextrous.
Essentially, yes, they are ambidextrous. So the MMA strength doesn't make the left hand dominant, it just pushes the person into the ambidextrous category.
And the ruling for an ambidextrous person is what?
It's clear. They default to the standard ruling, which is the left hand.
Oh, interesting.
The law views the left hand as the left hand of everyone, unless the individual's skill profile forces a reversal, like a pure lefty, where the right is truly defective.
Since the right hand is fully functional for Malacca, the left arm is the correct placement.
That's the conclusion. It's a clean answer derived from a deeply nuanced debate. The law prefers the certainty defined by learned control over the ambiguity of inherent power, especially when that learned control is so functional.
And this final conclusion reminds us why the authorities warned against overcomplicating things.
Yes, they strongly dismiss the notion of trying to wear tefillin on both arms as a way to solve the ambiguity. They called it a severe delusion.
The law demands clarity. Clarity based on the definition of the self.
We started with a simple ritual question and ended up with a legal framework that asks, what is the true measure of human control?
The key takeaway is that handedness, in this context, it's a legal construct, not a biological one. It's a synthesis of learned habit, skill, and raw power.
All measured against the goal of identifying the weaker hand.
And when we connect this back to the metaphorical understanding we uncovered, that the left hand is associated with the passive, with delay, with the cursed earth, while the right hand is active and positive. The ritual takes on a much deeper meaning.
Well, if the law mandates binding this sacred spiritual object to the arm defined by weakness and passivity, it encourages a final provocative thought for you to consider.
When you put on that phylactery, are you binding it there to give strength to your weaker, passive side to elevate it?
Or are you putting reins on the active, dominant side of your being to ensure that all your strength and power is governed and restrained by the divine command?
Which side of you needs the control more?
It's a choice that defines your true relationship between power and purpose.
Always more to learn. And that's the end of this deep dive.